a shot in the dark. Wary sort of spark. I'm a light that's too bright for me to see.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right, here we go, kids. Episode 192. All right, well, as is my tradition, it is time for the weekend recap. It's Monday, and this was a weekend of firsts. You know, I know what you're thinking. I know what first. If you listen, you know what I'm talking about. But there was another first. Are you ready? I played cornhole for the first time. Now, I know what you're thinking. How could you possibly have not played cornhole before? You hang in the young adult scene of Denver, Colorado. I mean, everyone plays cornhole. I mean, that's what we do here, right? We go to devotional activities and we play games while drinking. That is pretty much the entire social life of someone under 50 and single in Denver, Colorado. But I have resisted it. I have a long-standing annoyance with games. Though, I mean, don't get me wrong, some of my best conversations I've ever had in my life were had around, I don't play bridge, but the bridge table at the Farrier's house when we were going to Thomas Aquinas College was like place of true dialogue. I mean, conversation. I'm my family, rummy players. I mean, they are gin rummy fanatics. I am the champion. Don't let anyone tell you different. But, you know, it's just when you got people together and you're drinking and hanging out, I mean, it's a perfect time for conversation. And I just think that, I think that games get in the way of that. I'm famous for this. You know, my good friend Ken Kramer just always wants to play a game. And he's one of the most interesting human beings I know. And I'm like, I don't want to play a game. I want to talk to you. I want to find out what you think about things, which we did plenty of that too. But I miss Ken. Shout out to Ken and Laura Kramer up on the reservation in Montana. All right, so, but I played cornhole at the 32nd birthday of Kathleen Mason. And I have to say I got decent at it. I mean, I can't say I'm good by any means. I was horrible. Now, I wore a shirt that was kind of a button up because it was like a party, you know, and it was a little warm out and I started getting kind of like, I was getting kind of thrown off by my shirt a little bit. So, you know, I think next time I'm willing to play again. I'm going to wear a t-shirt next time. I think I can do this. I was horrible at first. I was like missing the entire like area. It was really bad. But once it's kind of like bowling, you have to kind of figure out your stroke, you know, and once I figured out that you had to lob it a little, you know, I was doing okay. So cornhole that happened this weekend. Saturday sucked. It's like, that's all I'm going to say about Saturday. I had a great night's sleep, woke up ready to go, and just I could not get anything moving, and I was like in a funk, just a little depressed or something. Just I blame it on the cornhole. I got nothing done that I wanted to get done. I tried, and I just got idiocy, and just I was just ridiculous. But managed to get a little bit of work done, managed to go to confession, managed to kind of pull out of it. Sunday morning, I just woke up rough. Just like woke up, hitting the snooze, ended up going to a different church than I normally go to because I overslept. I just could not get moving at all. I felt like hell. But Sunday ended good, you know, after a lot of running around and a little stress, you know, trying to get everything ready. I was off to the event of the weekend. And if you listen, you know what that was? It was Hakuna Matako, as I named it. So if you're a first time listener, or you haven't been listening much, I made a deep confession some time ago that I had never seen The Lion King. And it's been this long attempt by Antoinette Golish, shout out to Antoinette Golish, to try to get me to see The Lion King. They had so we watched a VHS tape. I mean, come on, man. It's like, how long has it been since anybody, we were using the word tracking, like we're trying to find how to adjust the tracking. How long has it been since you had to worry about the tracking on a movie you were watching? But it was good. It kind of brought me back. It brought me back. So I went over to the home of the lovely and talented Antoinette Golish and was just shown mad hospitality by the entire Golish family. So shout out to Colleen Golish for Papa Golish and Ross Golish, who just knocked the taco game out of the park. I dry rubbed some grass-fed skirt steak and had some chicken I'd been marinating. Brought that over. I grilled it up. He was cooking. He was prepping for like 2 days. I mean, he made these shrimp tacos with this chipotle tartar sauce and this sautéed shrimp and a little bit of this strawberry kind of a strawberry salsa on top of it. Oh my goodness, it was so good. And this pork, oh, it's amazing. The guy's a master. I am but a humble cook. That guy's a real chef. And I got to work with his knife. He had like this Japanese knife. I mean, it's like the Hattori Hanzu sword from Kill Bill. I mean, it was so sharp and it worked so well. I now am on the quest to have real knives. I mean, I've got okay kind of knives, but I mean, it makes me want to chop if I have a good knife. I'm ready to invest in at least one really, really good chef knife at this point in the game. So Sarah Stacy came over and the lovely and talented Perry West rolled in classic Perry fashion, late from a flow trap in swim trunks and a wrinkled t-shirt, no shoes on. It's absolutely gorgeous. I love Perry West so much. It was such classic Perry. The guy is so brilliant. I can't wait for his record to come out. I had a great time, met a few new people, and hung out with people I'd met a couple of times. It's such a great time. So there you go. Just tacos, and more tacos in the crucible of hospitality and love that was the Golish home. Shout outs to just everyone involved. Big thanks for making that happen. All right, so I'm going to do a show where I am doing commentary. This is going to hands down be the most belated and most overly serious commentary that has ever been done on the movie The Lion King. So I finally watched The Lion King and I have thoughts. So that's what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about some themes that I found interesting in The Lion King. So spoiler alert, if you don't know how it ends, I got to give a shout out to Zach Candler for the spoiler alert. I was texting with him and I told him I was talking about The Lion King today, and our one of my favorite people in resident space plumber, Zach Candler, shout out to you. He said, why don't you warn them? Spoiler alert. I mean, it's only been over 20 years this movie's been out. So anyway, so spoiler alert, if you just really been waiting to see The Lion King, I think I was the last person on earth to see The Lion King. So spoiler alert, here it comes. All right, so I have some thoughts on this. This is I take stories very seriously, and the taking of children's stories very seriously is a very old tradition. You know, and I've did a whole show on fairy tales and stuff some time ago. And I like to quote Robert Bly, the guy who wrote Iron John. He talks about how these old fairy tales, these old fables are like, they're like pure mountain water that has been filtered through layers and layers and layers of sediment to where there's just nothing left but the essential. And that's why they're so strange, right? I don't know that that's exactly applied here. This is more of a fleshed out kind of a, you know, Disney thing, but children's stories can be a great way to tell some of the biggest stories. And I think there are only a few great stories, you know, that say, a man goes on a long journey, a man fights a great battle. There's these different stories. There's only a handful of them. And there's a couple kind of embedded in this movie. And they're these real deep human architectonic iconic stories that that speak to us on such a deep human level. The overall structure of The Lion King seems to be like Hamlet. Thanks. Shout out to Sarah Stacy for pointing that out. It is Hamlet for all practical purposes. But I'm not really so much interested in that larger story, so to speak. I'm really interested in the true story that's embedded in it, and that's the story of Simba, right? And the struggle of a prince, you know, when he's no longer a prince because the king is dead and he's no longer king, and the prince doesn't become king, right? That's Hamlet, right? But in the vengeance that takes place and all that. But I think that embedded in that context is a more architectonic, deeply rooted, basic story that we all have to go through. But I think it's especially arcs with the masculine. And like all things that arc deeply with the masculine, women love it because they are attracted to and love true masculinity and even the true struggle that we as men kind of fight. And that is a fight of identity. And so today I want to talk about identity and sonship and all that in the context of The Lion King. Chalk this up under things they probably wouldn't let me do on normal Catholic Creed. All right, you're listening to The Counter Position. We'll be right back. I'm your host, Andrew Whaley.
Let my sacred word to mutter. Ran too fast and turned to butter. I'm a bit too much for me to chew.
You're listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at breadboxmedia.com.
Let me skip across the pond. I'm an ocean on and on. I'm a fish with no bowl that I outgrew. Lift my blood. See, only one on track.
Welcome back to The Counter Position. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right. Talking about The Lion King, talking about the journey of sonship, the journey of identity. We're talking about that in the context. So for start off, there's this concept of natural law, right? And things with talking animals are always weird, and especially when there's like predators and prey involved, that just freaks me out, you know? I'm kind of like, what? I mean, they're persons, but they eat each other. It's just like the moment I saw that opening scene, and it's like, it looks like National Geographic, except animated. And then there's this whole thing and he comes out and the prince has been born. And I'm just sitting there thinking, what, you know, okay. Sidebar on weirdness in animals that talk in cartoons. Speaking of Disney, what is it with Pluto and Goofy? I mean, that always just creeped me out. You know, Goofy is a dog, but he talks. And he's clothed, and he lives in a house, and he drives a car, and he walks around, and that's fine. That's standard, you know. We won't even get into the fact, like, some of them are, I mean, are the talking animals supposed to wear clothes? Because Porky Pig doesn't have pants on. I mean, that's a little freaky, right? But Goofy's a dog, and that's all good. But Goofy has a dog named Pluto. A dog owns a dog. And that dog is naked and on all fours and acts like a dog and barks and eats out of a bowl. There's just something deeply disturbing about that whole thing. But all right, so inside bar on Goofy and Plato. So you have this opening scene about the circle of life, right? And that just hit me as like this natural law, right? I mean, I overthink everything. Right. That's just how it is. When I observe something, I'm just thinking. And so if you're thinking, what, where did he get this? Exactly. I'm a weird guy. But you see this circle of life and you see the prince, they comes out, he raises the prince up. The prince has been born. They're going to have a continued monarchy. The king is proud. The queen is there. You know, it's all going on. There's this big coronation scene, right? Hold on, coffee sip. Now, then, what fascinated with me is that the zebras, they're prey, right? And later on, we see, you know, a part of a zebra being fed to the hyenas, right? The zebras are prey, right? There's all these different things there, and they're all paying homage to the king. And there's an order, the circle of life. They're singing about it, right? And then later on, they're talking about it, the circle of life. And he's talking about all this will be yours. But I had a great moment while we're watching this, and no one picked it up. He says, well, one day, son, this will all be yours. And of course, I said, what, the curtains? He says, no, not the curtains. Monty Python reference. No one got it. He says something about the gazelles. And I'm sitting there thinking, but you eat the gazelles. And Simba says, but we eat the gazelles. I'm like, yes, they're going to address this. And he talks about the circle of life. And there's like, there's a natural order. Things are ordered, and beings find their proper place in that order, right? I think the funniest part about all that, the funniest moment in that is later on in the movie, after the, I forgot her name. Is it Nala? The grown up little pup that was the female lion comes to find Simba, and she's chasing the warthog around, and then they realize what's going on, and they're all like making introductions, and I'm sitting there thinking she was just trying to eat him. And the little guy, I don't know what he's, Timon or whatever, he's a meerkat, I think, or something like that. And he's like, he just says the obvious. She was just trying to eat him. Am I the only one that's okay with not okay with that? I'm like, I love Disney when they put I love cartoons in general when they put in the more, the adult side, you know, kind of what we're thinking. But before I move on from this concept of natural law and the circle of life, you see the hyenas, and the hyenas just represent just absolute disordered, mindless hunger. Now, nature in reality is ordered, mindless hunger, but these guys are just, they're, you know, in a world where they've been anthropomorphized, you know, they've been personalized. These things are just crazy and laughing, and they live in, and they're just pure hunger and madness. And where do they dwell? They dwell in the elephant graveyard, in the place of death. When you step outside of that circle of life, outside of natural law, outside of the greater order that puts our faculties and our hungers in place, you are in the place of death, right? And they exist in that place. That is where evil lies. Evil lies outside of the life. And in evil, and you see Scar there, you see these hyenas, you see the manipulation of evil by evil in that place of death. And that's meant to be in contrast to the Pride Lands, which are where things are ordered and things flourish and nature cooperates in this circle of life. There is a deep lesson for what's going on in our world these days right there. So then you're introduced to this relationship with Simba and his father Mufasa, right? And I love the playful intimacy between this deep, deep power that is the father and this burgeoning little power that is the son, right? And you see them playing, right? You see them playing at battle and fighting, and he's attacking his dad and all that. Just, you know, and I need to shout out to Father Philip Chavez to Dr. Philip Chavez, sorry. His thought is going to be hidden all over this place, all over this talk. He founded and ran the Amator Institute that I ended up running, the Amator Institute for a while, a Catholic men's institute that's no longer happening. But that his thought is going to be, and also the thought of John Eldredge from Wild at Heart is kind of all over this. This is a movie that any little kid that you wanted to kind of teach that lesson, this would be the movie to show him. But in both of them, and in, have imparted this idea to me. That's like, it's so, so important that there be intimacy between a father and son. Physical intimacy. You have to know what he feels like, what he smells like. There has to be a deep wrestling, fighting, tickling intimacy between father and son. That is how masculinity is imparted. You have to, and it's more than just masculinity, it's identity, right? You have to be able to play with and attack and in a safe way be dangerous with this incredibly beautifully powerful thing that is your father, right? I was just listening to Breadbox Media. I was listening to Mark Shea's show earlier today, and there was during the break, there's a new little snippet from Chris Stefanik, my friend. And, Chris was talking about C.S. Lewis and Aslan and how they say that at one point they said, oh, he was a lion. He's a lion. I thought he was a person. No, he's a lion. He's like, oh my goodness. Is he safe? He says, no, he's not. He's not safe. He's good. You know, that's one of the greatest lines that Lewis ever wrote. And because it really explains who Christ is. And that gets down to the point of what the Father is for. The Father is to impart to you a vision of your Heavenly Father, right? That is the role. When things work out, when things play out as they're supposed to, the Father kind of is an icon of God the Father to the Son. And that deep, deep, deep intimacy, even physical intimacy, that mock battle, that tickling, that fighting, that wrestling with the Father, it will lay the foundation of a true natural masculine character in a deep, deep identity that later on will show up with a solidity in that son's life and a solidity in his act of prayer. And I think that was just beautifully characterized in the movie. And it's not just masculinity he's imparting. He's imparting identity. He's imparting his identity. The first identity we have in the thing that the base that all of our further identities are built upon, the one, the sine qua non, the that without which it can't happen, is to be a beloved son. That is the key to everything. And you learn that from your father. Or from the mentors in your life that take the place of your father if he's not around. You know, I remember I didn't have a particularly, when I was very small, like Simba, I may have, I don't really remember. But at the point that I can really remember, I didn't have a deeply physical, intimate relationship with my father. We didn't, you know, wrestle a lot. And I was a little scared of my dad, not because he never laid a hand on me as far as I can remember, but there was just a distance between us, right? And I can remember one day being at Mass and my dad grabbed me to try to kiss me during the sign of peace, and it scared me. Because it was something I wasn't quite used to. And he was trying. I see now he was trying. And so I didn't experience this really. Right. And I didn't really get that. And I experienced the unsuredness and the lack of masculine character and the instability in my character and the instability in prayer and all that comes from this. In some way, I'm boxing with shadows by saying this. I'm telling you this from the lack, right? But I've seen it in my friends. I've seen it in Justin Schneer and his boys. I've seen it in my friends' families. But all right, so let's go to the break, and we're going to pick up the next thread. When we get back, you're listening to The Counterposition. This is the absolutely most belated commentary on Lion King ever done. I am your host, Andrew Whaley.
Lin how we crave hanging in his dark.
Redbox Media, now is a great way for you to go deeper with your favorite show or shows in our programming lineup. With our Friend of the Show opportunity, you get extra exclusive content from your favorite show hosts and lots of extra love from the shows and hosts you love. Become a friend of the show by clicking on the link on our website or app menu. Your $10 monthly premium membership will unlock an exclusive world just for you. Support your favorite show today as a friend of the show. Friend of the Show premium memberships exclusively for you with Redbox Media.
People singing, please don't stay, but please don't go.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. And I am currently engaged in the single latest and single most serious commentary on the movie The Lion King ever done in the history of man. Thanks for playing along. So at the next thing that happens in the story is the loss of his father. He's murdered by his uncle, Scar, because he wants the throne, but the boy's in the way, right? And Scar plays the role of the accuser. He is the conniving, anti-nature, anti-identity that lurks in the narrative, right? He enters the narrative, cuts Mufasa off, cuts Simba off from Mufasa. And then Simba is left after the death of his father. And when your father is taken, you know, a son has his dad off to war, or an accident happens, or maybe divorce happens, or maybe just like, you know, in my father's generation, my grandfather's, I mean, they came back from World War II, just scarred and quiet and cold and distant, some of them. And maybe it was that type of removal of the source of identity. But whenever that source of identity in a son is removed from him, there is a space open and the accuser will move in. And what does the accuser do? The accuser lies, and the accuser introduces shame into the equation. Been doing the same thing since the beginning. Think about the garden, right? Think about Adam and Eve. He lies and then introduces shame. Now, not saying that shame isn't proper in the sense at times. There is time when shame enters, but that boy didn't have anything. He didn't do anything wrong other than just be a boy. You know, when he lost his dad, and at that moment, he's driven out with the intent of killing him. But fate with Providence has something different. So he's cut off from community. He's cut off from his source of identity. He's cut off from that context, and he moves out of the circle of life. And though Providence moves him out of the hand of those who would kill him, he enters into this new place, you know, and it's kind of like that classic tale, you know, where they eat the poppies and they forget, you know, he eats these crazy grubs and he meets this meerkat and this, or whatever that little guy is, and this warthog. And it's funny and it's comic. They're the comical characters. It's hilarious. But we will look for when mission is taken away from us, when purpose, when plan, when identity is taken from us, we will look for community and activity that dulls us, that numbs us, right? And so he lives in a place that is less death. They're just eating grubs, right? And now think about this. This isn't a lion and he's eating grubs. That in itself is one, even though it's so playful in the show, that is one of the most tragic things, right? You see that he's clearly not where he's supposed to be. He's not living who he's supposed to be. He's not living as who he is supposed to be. And And so people, when they lack purpose, when they lack identity, especially when a young man lacks identity, lacks purpose, lacks mission, he will find something to numb him. Alcohol or drugs or pornography or just less. He'll get very practical maybe. You know, when you see the whole thing, it's funny. It's like this Hakuna Matata, you know, no worries. No worries. Don't worry. There's nothing to worry about. But there's everything to worry about. Nature itself is being destroyed. His people have been, the power has been usurped, and his people are being tyrannized. And so as funny as that whole thing is, the Hakuna Matata and the funny song, it's tragic. It's tragic. And what we do is what they say to do. We put our past behind us, right? And that sounds good. But sometimes what you have to do is you have to face your past. You have to own up to that, right? That's the prodigal son. I mean, he's not out in sin and in dissipation, but we think that's what that's about what the prodigal son is about, is he took his dad's money and went and did bad and then came back and asked for forgiveness. You know, as I quote all the time, Thomas Merton says in Thoughts and Solitude, I think it is, he says that, no, it's life and holiness. It's in life and holiness. He says that sin is not the doing of this thing you shouldn't do, or the not doing of this other thing that you should do. Sin is a refusal to be who you're called to be, who you really are, a manifested son of the living God. And so this farcical time where he's just out there running around eating grubs and stuff, it's like he's eating the poppies and he can't remember now. You know, he's put his past behind me, and his past was his source of identity, right? He's put himself behind him. So then there's this scene, you know, that the next thing that happens is like I'm just going to call her Nala. It's the female version of Simba, the girl lion. I can't remember. I think it's Nala. She comes and finds him, and he is, I mean, this is like so cliche, but he's in Plato's cave, right? He is shackled and looking at the false and mistaking it for the true, and he cannot turn around and see, because the turnaround is the past, and he is living in the place named past behind you. He cannot turn around and see the fire. He sees only that which is cast on the wall. And so, as Plato says, if someone would rescue this person, would unshackle him, that be it grace, be it something coming from outside, a person, something has to unshackle us, something has to shake us. And after this initial shaking, she is this source of an arousal for him, an arousal by beauty. The beauty, the feminine beauty comes. And it seems like two things can rouse us from that. It can be beauty, and for men, especially the feminine beauty, or it can be hitting rock bottom and just getting deep remorse and turning like the prodigal son. But really, that turning at the end of that rock bottom fall is a memory of beauty. It's a memory of the community and the identity that one had, right? And so she tries to wake him up out of it, and it doesn't. And she can... The feminine can give so many gifts to the masculine, but the one thing that the feminine cannot impart to us is masculinity. The feminine can inspire us. The feminine can activate latent masculinity and latent identity that's in us that has been so buried by that layer and layer of dullness and numbness, and it can activate what's there, but it can't impart. Because the masculine imparts the masculine. The source of identity imparts identity. And so the next person enters is the monkey guy with the staff, with the weird, the shakers on the end or whatever. He comes and he mentors. He awakens and mentors Simba. He reminds him of who he is. And he takes him in that moment. He takes him to the stream. And he shows him, and he sees his face, and he says, that's just my reflection, right? He can't see it. He says, no, look closer. And that reflection, when he takes a deep, deep look, that's why Merton, again, talks about that the search for self is really the search for God. Because if you really find yourself, and you really know yourself, you'll know yourself from the causes, and your causes is your source of identity. And so he sees that vision, and he has that moment. He has that moment. We see that moment in the life of Christ when, after his baptism, when the voice comes out of the sky, and it's his Father, and he hears the words that every son longs to hear. You are my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. You know, when the prodigal gets back, the older boy can't handle it. And the father looks at the older boy and he says, everything I have is yours, and you are with me always. You know, those are the things that we want to hear. That is what, in that moment, that imparting of identity from his father, that we are reawakening of who he is, came from the source of that identity, right? And that is what activates him finally. And he moves, he acts. Now, that he was moved by beauty, he was moved by the feminine. It moved him, it changed him. You could see the change in him. And then the mentor can pick it up, can take that reactivated masculinity, that reactivated source of identity in him, and then move him towards, but all of that, father, mentor, whatever, you have to come back to the source of identity, and that is hearing from your true father, from your true source, you are my beloved son in whom I am well pleased. And that's what happens. And when it happens, he moves. He acts, right? You know, so then he has to move. He has to go away from the place named put your past behind you. But to move away from putting your past behind you is to face reality, including what you've done, including where you're from, including who you are. And that is battle. And so he goes into battle. That it's the only battle worth doing. And it's the only battle. The battle has been happening inside of him the entire time. That same battle is happening inside each one of us all the time. And so that's the only battle worth fighting, really, is the battle of identity. So we're going to pick that up when we get back. After the break, you're listening to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Raley. We'll be right back.
Then all the color glass, that painter's palette smash, all the colors of my soul.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media, get the app, change the world.
I'm a hyena laughing fool, I'm a hero without anyone to see. Love bedecked myself in toys, I'm a poor and kingly boy. Oh, I'm lovely, and I'm dull.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right, we are doing an extended commentary on The Lion King of all things in this world. And we are talking about the nature of sonship and identity and about the recovery of identity. So when last we left our hero Simba, he has been awakened from his numbness and slumber. And he is activated. He has been awakened by beauty and aroused by beauty and reminded by beauty. And then he's picked up by a mentor, and a mentor tells him who he is and then draws him to that. But all the mentor can do is take you to the source of that identity. That's all a good spiritual director can do for you. A spiritual director can't, Wojtyła says the person is incommunicabilis, totally incommunicabilis, is incommunicable. You cannot want for someone else. You can't be someone else. All you can do is lead them. And like Mary, who takes the servants to Christ and says, do whatever he tells you, he leads Simba to the source of his identity, and he hears from his father, you are my beloved son in whom I am well pleased, right? You are a king. You had this. You're not living as a king. You are a king. You're my son, right? And so he goes into battle. Now, what happens when you go to face that? The accuser will rear his head again. And where you have been reminded of your identity, the accuser will remind you of your shame. And it is literally an overcoming of yourself. The accuser will say, you are shame. He will remind you. He will give you a false identity. He will name you. If you do not let God name you, if you do not let your source name you, then the accuser will name you. And you can believe this. And if you believe this, it is death until you choose to see it as the lie that it is. And so, after the accuser tries to stop him by claiming that his identity is shame, and he enters into the real battle there, and he overcomes it. He overcomes Scar. And in the end, he answers with mercy. He answers him with the mercy that he received, but not on purpose. And he says, go. He says the same thing that he says to him. And then he tries to fight and he ends up killing him. He ends up sending him off the cliff. And so then we see what happens. What happens when you've overcome yourself, when you have faced yourself, when you've done battle with the shame, you've done battle with numbness, you've faced all that and you've reclaimed your identity. What happens? Then you go into that battle and then nature is restored. We see the clouds come in and rain falls, the herds return, all this stuff, things are green again. We're back in the Shire, so to speak. You know, and that's nature is back in its proper order at that point. And, you know, it's like the scripture says that that all creation is groaning in anticipation for the manifestation of the sons of God. You know, and we see that. We see that in that the Son of God, the Son of the King, is not in his proper place and nature is suffering for it. We see that today, right? I mean, we see it all around us, both in human nature and in nature itself. But after that battle is won, that is a time to take your place. That is a time to, and then you can really impart your name. You can impart a name. You can impart identity to others. That when you know who you are, when you are in front of reality, when you are standing in relationship to that source of your identity and you are living as a manifested son of the living God, when you are in that place, that is when you can create. Now, any creation outside of that is just mere making. To be involved in real creation, any kind of, you have to be involved in co-creation because only God can create. John Paul II talks extensively about this in his letter to artists, that we make, God creates, ex nihilo, but God makes a place for us and invites us into a real, real engagement with our will to actually be involved in creation. You know, that's why I always say that Nietzsche is so powerful as a writer because he's so profoundly wrong in an important way. And it isn't until I would say that John Paul II, Caravaggio's work, answers that. What is the nature of the power of the will in creation, right? And so with that entering into the source as your identity, in living in that, you can actually be involved in a real co-creation because you're tapped in. And the primary co-creation that happens, the one that is most deeply like the creation of God, is the fathering of a son, the fathering of a daughter. So when you enter into that, you know, John Paul II calls it a communio personarum, a communion of persons in the family, images the Trinity. And when you enter into that deep self-giving love that you can only really give yourself in, if you know who you are and you are tapped into your source, then real creation can happen. And that's the last thing we see in the movie. We see a new prince born. We see that he has truly overcome himself and he has been involved in a real co-creation, both with Nala and with the source, to make another king and to name that king. And that is the place where the story ends, you know, and it's a big victory, right? But the truth be told, the reason that stories like this are kind of rough, because in reality, we don't have Mufasa for a dad, and we're not Simba. In reality, our dads are one part Simba and one part Scar and maybe a little bit Warthog. And so are we, every one of us. But I mean, these archetypal stories, you paint the evil as evil and the good as good so that we can be seen. It's like the Lord of the Rings, you know? I mean, that's, it affects how you see the world too. My grandparents, generation saw all war as World War II. It was Mordor, you know, it was Lord of the Rings. In my father's generation, they see all war as Vietnam. Right. And the truth is somewhere in between the two, right? Well, it's true of this internal battle too. It's not as clean as that. You know, it's not as clean. We're all a mixed bag. You know, I've heard it said that, there are no black hats and white hats. We're all just wearing different shades of gray hat. We're, none of us are truly good guys, so to speak, you know? And so it's rough, you know, cause you're like, you get caught up in that and you see this, and then you start reflecting on your own life and your own family and your own journey as a son and your own, and it's just not that clean. And it's all just, it's funny. It's like stories like this, these architect's tonic stories call us to something because they activate so deeply within us the awareness of this giant delta, this giant gap between the way things are and the way things ought to be. And it hurts, right? But it calls us on, hopefully, right? It activates that. It shows us the difference. I remember going to see the Lord of the Rings movie, the very first one, at the theater in downtown Ventura, California. And I came away from that, and I was just kind of I remember walking up that big steep hill towards the statue of Saint Junipero Serra, who was then just Blessed Junipero Serra, there at the top of California Street in downtown Ventura. And I was just searching my heart because I was feeling something. I was just searching, and I was like, what's going on? And I just realized I just wanted to be good. I wanted to live virtuously. I wanted to fight a great battle. I wanted to be brave and fight evil. But then by the time I got to my car, it was like, I realized that, you know, it's not that clean. There is no, it would be almost evil if there was a dragon to go attack with a sword and get yourself killed as a martyr. That's the mistake that these people are making in radical Islam. They're selling them on this false battle. Just here's the big evil, go kill it. But the evil's within them. You know, and it's interesting. They just now found out that the guy that did the drove that truck through all those people in Nice, he had been on a dating app, hooking up with both men and women. There's two major attacks. This is something I would have never seen. Two major attacks. Islam, ISIS, in this radicalization is attracting people that are deeply conflicted and fighting an internal war, and then calling them to an easy answer by naming this evil and telling them that it's outside themselves and they have to go just do battle with it. And they got serious, didn't it? Anyway, there you go. The Lion King, ladies and gentlemen. this is why you don't want to see movies with me, because I'll just make Monty Python jokes and then get overly serious afterwards. Everyone that knows me that's listening is going, this is so much like hanging out with Waylay. It's absolutely goofy and way too serious. But not like Goofy and Disney, because I don't even have a dog. And if I did have a dog, I wouldn't be a dog. That's just disordered and wrong. All right, so thanks for coming along. Thanks for playing this little game we like to call the counter position. I'll catch you on the other side. So let's pull the plug, pop the cork on another episode of The Counter Position. We'll see you on the other side.
I'll take your place, marble stone. I'll take your place, marble stone.